So today's episode, as part of our milestone series, is going to be focused on the Council of Nicaea. We're celebrating its 1700th anniversary this year, 2025. And I'm joined today by two of our faculty members here at Southeastern, Dr. Steve McKinyon and Dr. Steve Ecker. And both of these guys are experts in historical theology, theology, patristics, and all things related. So they're going to help us understand not only kind of what was going on historically at the Council of Nicaea, but practically, what are the implications of the conversation and the debate that was kind of raging during that time? And how does it kind of influence our churches, our ministry leadership, and things today? So join with me. Let's get the conversation started. So today we're talking about the Council of Nicaea. This year we're celebrating the 1700th anniversary of the first church council. Got significance on a lot of different levels. But let's just kind of start the conversation with what it is, what it was, and we can get into kind of the impact it has. So maybe talk about what is the Council of Nicaea, and you know, how are we going to get around it?
Yeah. So Christians have always gotten together to settle questions and disputes and issues that come up. The earliest gathering of Christian leaders and thinkers and talkers and apostles was the Jerusalem Council in the Bible, mm-hmm. where they got together to answer the question, what do we do with Gentile believers that maybe haven't come out of the same background that we've come out of as Jewish believers? And so churches have always needed to answer specific questions for specific times. And the Council of Nicaea was the first of those councils that included pastors and bishops and teachers from all over the Roman Empire. So we call it the first ecumenical council. There had been mostly regional or kind of like associational gatherings before then, where Christians would answer questions about, hey, how are we going to deal with this particular issue when we're being persecuted? What happens when, in the midst of persecution, Christians have to, turn in their Bibles? What do we do if someone actually turns it in? How are we going to address that? How are we going to deal with it? But the Council of Nicaea in the year 325 is called to deal with a very particular issue, and that is the question of how is Jesus related to the Father. So Christians had always believed in God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, right? When Jesus gives us the Great Commission in Matthew 28, baptize in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So it's not so much the question of do we believe in one God who is three, but how are we going to explain this, right? What kind of language are we going to use? So the Council of Nicaea gets called to deal with that issue because there's this big conflict that's going on down in Egypt, right, that they really need to address. Right.
So when you think about that, I mean, you're talking about the most critical aspect then, foundationally speaking, of our faith. What we believe about Jesus is the most crucial thing, yeah, that distinguishes us or identifies us as Christians. So its level of importance would have justified, all right, we're going to bring everybody together to talk about this one. It may address a specific problem that's going on, but this is going to be kind of foundational. So the significance of it then and now, both is kind of obvious. But let's translate into the, because maybe the same arguments aren't going on that we'll get into that they were dealing with. Why then is it important for pastors and churches to be talking about it today?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as a historian, if you think about this, it's critical for us because we're not doing theology, you know, in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. We actually, the way that we even speak, the way that we talk, so much of our liturgies in the church, whether it's our practice or our theological formulation, it's not detached from the past. And so this actually is super helpful for us because it helps us to attune ourselves to the way Christians had addressed this issue, obviously, in this case, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But more important than just attuning to what the Christians were saying here, let's say in the beginning part of the fourth century, it is their understanding of the scriptures. It's mm-hmm. their understanding of how they're going to go about understanding both the scriptures, the Old Testament, but also the apostolic writings that they're using as scripture here in the fourth century. So there's an interpretive element for them in that. That becomes very, very helpful for us then as we think about that, because we're not doing theology detached from those who have gone before us. We're actually, again, sort of historical terms, we're standing on their shoulders then. And I think one of the things that I appreciate about this as a historian is it helps to give us some sense of explanation for some of the language that may have been caught by Christians more than it's actually been taught. So this actually gives us a chance to really understand what is the language that you're using, to Dr. McKinyon's point. Why are they using this language? And what, again, I so appreciated what Dr. McKinyon said about there are particular unique historic issues that come up that need to be addressed. And so that really becomes what we're looking at as a way of then understanding the past so that we can better steward the gospel in our contemporary presence.
So the centrality of the issue is clear and obvious. Maybe one of a secondary benefit, as you're describing it, kind of comes to my mind, is this become a model, not in an ecumenical sense as we would use the word today, but maybe even within a particular tradition like our own, to say, here's how conversations can happen, and here's how we can discuss the things that are the essentials and how that then translates into a different philosophy of ministry or different approach. But here's a way we can join together and rally around the cornerstones or foundational pillars, if you will, of our faith. And I hadn't maybe necessarily thought about that before now, but hearing you describe it, it does set a little bit of a model, not only of how we look at Bible and tradition and all those things, but even how they approached it and their willingness, because we live in a day and age, right, where people don't seem willing to be, collaborative in how we think about things or work together. We're just so polarizing in that way. Okay, so in thinking about the significant for churches today, let's talk about how the council actually came together. Like, who brought the council together and why did they do it?
Yeah, so persecution had just raged through the Roman Empire in the second and the third centuries. And emperors, for a variety of different reasons usually from one emperor to the next, tended to, persecute Christians as opposed to other groups. There were some other groups they persecuted, but Christians really bore the brunt of it. And part of the reason why was because the Christian message about Jesus really posed a affront against what had been the traditional Greek and Roman way of doing religion, mm-hmm. kind of the mm-hmm. paganism mm-hmm. of the day. And so Christians stood out as those who said, we're going to pledge our allegiance to this one God, and we're not going to participate in all of the other religious activities and duties and that sort of thing in the Roman Empire. The empire was a very religious and a set of nations, and really required people to, go to the temple, to make sacrifices to the gods, to, obtain certificates that said they really were good Roman citizens because they shared in the religion.
So politics and religion were really blurred together. They weren't clearly separated from church and state type of thing. So they're operating in a completely different context.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what it meant was that when things were difficult in the empire, mm-hmm. Maybe the economy goes down, maybe there are people from the outside that are nibbling around at the edges of the empire and taking some land, that the emperors needed a scapegoat. And they also wanted to kind of placate the other gods, right? And it said, well, if we can make everybody do this, maybe we sacrifice a few Christians to the lions, it'll be all right. So along the way, right at the beginning of the fourth century, the emperor, a guy named Constantine, mm-hmm. Became a Christian. And he, for a whole host of complicated reasons, decided, yep, I think I'm going to be a Christian now. And so he ended the persecution of Christians. Mm-hmm. And once persecution ended, it really allowed Christians to begin to engage more in the conversations that are going on in society, to have a bigger role within the empire. And so the Emperor Constantine, when he saw this conflict that's going on down in Egypt, that was threatening to spill over into a lot of other places in the empire. Constantine said, let's get all of the leading pastors and bishops and theologians together so that you guys can settle this problem, so that there's not greater conflict within the empire. I mean, every politician wants unity. Right, they want, certainly, you know, support. They want people to get along right. with one another. And of course, Christians want that as well. And so it was a good kind of confluence of historical events where Constantine is willing as the emperor to put this council on, bring all these people together, and these pastors and theologians were to place, we need to come together and have this important conversation yeah. about who Jesus really is.
So I was going to say, what were some of the contributing pieces to this conversation? We've got to have this conversation, whether it's the nature of the conflict that was going on or just some other things that had led into it. What spawned it into that level where Constantine's like, hey, we really do need to deal
well,
with
this?
Well,
I think to Dr. McKinnon's point here, it's important to see from the outset here, you have different people participating and vested in the proceedings of the Council of Nicaea, but not necessarily for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. So obviously, whatever Constantine as a Roman emperor, as a politician and not a theologian, his concerns, his interest in relation to what the proceedings will look like and what the ultimate end goal is going to be much different than what was historically sure. like Alexander
right.
Of Alexandria or you know Athanasius behind the scenes. Their concern is immeasurably less political and is more theological mm. in nature, knowing the weight of the question that's being asked about who is this son, Jesus, and how does he ultimately relate to the Father?
Yeah, so, I think, I think what really kicks the need for this council off is there's a guy in Egypt in the city of Alexandria. His name is Arius. Mm-hmm. And Arius kind of is the end of a long line of preachers who, in their effort to describe the relationship between Jesus and God the Father, kind of had this idea that God the Father was the ultimate, the great, the biggest God, if you will, and that Jesus was lesser than him. And the reason why this was important for Arius was because he really wanted to emphasize that Jesus was a good example for us. And the Christians had, to this point, kind of gone back and forth with answering the question that Jesus asks in the Bible, which is the most important question for people to ask. Who do you say that I am?
Right.
And this becomes the question that Christians have kind of leaning back and forth between, well, we know that he's God, but we also know that he's human. And trying to bounce back and forth between how can Jesus be both God and be human meant that Christians sometimes their language, kind of lent them toward one way or the other. And Arius is in this track of thinking of Jesus being more human than being God so that he can be like a model for us and an example for us. Arius felt like if Jesus is fully God, then his sinless life, for example, wouldn't really mean anything because, well, of course he's sinless. He's God.
Right, you know,
it's
right.
kind of like an adult walking around looking at the little, three-month-old who is only crawling and saying, why can't you walk like I walk
right.
or something? And so Arius in posing that Jesus isn't fully God, that he's still divine in some way, but he's less than God is, creates this dichotomy, this where he separates Jesus from the Father, and he brings Jesus onto the side of creation rather than on the side of the Creator. And that division, what we talk about as the creator-creation distinction, is so fundamentally important for Christians. And Arius, in breaking the wall down between the Creator and the creation, is really what precipitates, we have to have this meeting to get these guys together
okay,
and talk
this
about
is an important
it.
Thing, right? So is he, Arius, thinking more in the theoretical, theological categories, or is he involved in ministry and preaching and teaching to where this view is influencing the other believers? So in other words, is he living in an ivory tower and he's doing this? It's like, hey, man, we got to correct the guy who's on the other end of the tower. Or is he actually now affecting and helping determine what actually Christians believe.
Yeah, no, and this is part of the problem. He's a pastor of a church, mm-hmm. and he's a very popular preacher, and he's also a songwriter. You know, and which is kind of interesting, but like how many lyrics to songs do we know that maybe we haven't listened to in a long time?
Right.
You know, and you hear the tune that comes up maybe in the grocery store or something, and you think, I know the words to that song. And so he was very influential, yeah. not just in Alexandria, but he was influential kind of spreading throughout the Roman Empire. And it was that influence that really brought this thing to a head that required that and necessitated a gathering together to come up with language. And really what they're doing is they're trying to say not what do Christians believe. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is to say what is language that we can use, we can come up with, that really does capture what we've already believed and that can keep us from falling off one side or the other, mm-hmm. right? It's like walking down a road, and there's a ditch on either side of it, and you want language that does that. It's kind of like, you know, saying the difference between here are 12 eggs and here's a dozen eggs.
Right.
Right? We've always talked about these being 12 eggs, and now, you know, if you've seen the SNL sketch
right,
with Nate Bargatze, you know, it's, well, let's come up with a word for that now.
Right. And what's the word for other things? Mm-hmm. Nothing.
That's exactly.
That's the only
we're just going to come up with it.
Right.
But the point is you're able to say the same thing mm-hmm. with different language.
Right.
And that's what these Christians are trying to do, is because, that they really are faced with how can we communicate the same scriptural gospel that we believed and confessed, but that say it in a way that precludes, say, what Arius and other people like him are saying.
Well, also just to add there, I think what Dr. McKinney is saying is so crucial because it, you know, you starts out with a question of Jesus, which is a question of Christology, mm. but it also relates to the doctrine of God, but it's also going to bleed over into the other doctrinal loci or places of theology where you're now addressing a question of the actual essence and heart of the gospel. This is why it's so applicable to pastors, because if Jesus is simply this moral example, mm-hmm. then he sounds super relatable to me. There's actually, I think, you know, anthropologically, there's an appeal that now he becomes relatable in the sense that if I can just do this, it actually bleeds us into a sense of moralism, which if you think about all of the other world religions outside of Orthodox biblical Christianity, there is this inherent sense of moralism. So it's actually, you talk about Dr. Pace, how this was so appealing to various people in the empire. It's appealing because it appeals anthropologically to our human sense
of
wanting to do something. We want to be the ones to put our hands on something and fix the problem. When the gospel is actually saying something entirely different.
You can't, right?
That's exactly right. So it's not a moralism, and that becomes part of the problem there, is it's not just about the question of who is Jesus or who is Jesus in relation to the Father. It's also a question about, well, who is the church and how is the gospel itself to be understood and what does it mean to be a human? And so all of these things come crashing together in a very, very important question that is not some ivory tower theological question. This matters greatly to the lives and the souls of people.
Answering that question about Jesus determines the answers to all the other questions that spill from that. So you mentioned Arius, that's kind of the antagonist, so to speak, in the conversation. Who are the other players that were involved? Names that like people would recognize or would need to know to say, here's some of the contributors to the conversation.
Yeah, really the two key figures are Alexander, who was the Bishop of Alexandria, and then a theologian named Athanasius. Athanasius wasn't a bishop at the time, but he becomes the primary defender of Nicaea and the one who is interpreting and explaining Nicaea to people afterwards. So those are kind of the big three. Like, they all start with A. It's a good a way to remember this. So
I like alliteration.
Alliteration, absolutely. So Arius is the antagonist, and then the protagonist are Alexander and Athanasius. And Athanasius really pushes this into the next generation because the Council of Nicaea isn't the end. Mm-hmm. There's ongoing discussion that happens. I mean, after Nicaea happens, you know, people largely looked at this and said, well, wait a minute, we didn't believe what Arius was saying. And so it didn't change much of what they were doing. But in those places where Arianism was arising, there really was a lot of conflict in churches. There's still theological conflict that happens in churches when, a teacher within the church or a pastor within the church says something that is contrary to the scriptures, and conflict can ensue. And so there was a lot of real legitimate conflict. Pastors and bishops who were being removed from their churches and because they were Arian, or in places where Arianism was winning the day, it might be that the Orthodox pastor was removed. And so you needed someone like Athanasius, who really was going to be on the kind of the tip of the spear with ensuring that this proper biblical way of understanding the gospel was what was being communicated in the churches throughout the empire.
Well, and I can imagine with the distortion of truth, even as we see today, right? People begin to manipulate it to their favor. So it's not just that they were theologically confused. It's not just that there was some motivation behind it that would have been similar to motivations today, where people would say, I'm going to focus on this element or this aspect of Jesus, mm-hmm. Because it furthers this type of understanding or this type of lifestyle or whatever it may be, and maybe gains influence for me. Or, you know, there's a lot of different motivating factors going into the people that are involved, right?
Well, yeah. And with the end of persecution, now Christianity is, one of the heralded religions. Eventually is going to be the religion of the empire. There is benefit. There's right. Political benefit. There's economic benefit. And just like you see in the New Testament, where Paul says there are these people who are using this, you know, Simon, right. The magician and others that, you know, they're kind of using this for their own gain. The same thing happens in the aftermath of Nicaea. People are trying to line up to curry favor with a political leader, with the emperor or someone like that. And the church, I mean, Christians are just trying to preach the gospel and see people come to know Jesus and see people built up in their faith and send missionaries around and that sort of thing. And so that this battle is not just an ivory tower, you know, how are we going to define the Trinity or something like that? It really is the heart and soul of the gospel and the church's life that's at stake.
I think the other thing too is think about the motivations, or you mentioned this idea of what are people's motives. The reality is, you know, even heretics in the church's history, really, do they ever set out to say, hey, I'm going to undermine the faith, right? So in Arius's case, right, he's trying to be faithful to the Bible, to the scriptures, especially Proverbs 8 and places like that. He's trying to do theological formulation to maintain and preserve something, but he's doing something where all of a sudden he is detaching himself from what Christians have believed going back to the first century, and obviously is doing something, as we talked about with these other different aspects of theology, where you end up with a different gospel. Mm-hmm. So we have to remember that in terms of the motivations, it's not always just that there is a malicious, evil, and willful, intentional motivation. Sometimes it's just a misguided motivation.
They find themselves drifting into the ditch, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it's also, and it may not be theological, right? You've got other figures there, for instance, like Eusebius of Caesarea, one of the church's early historians, who's close to the emperor. He's deeply concerned about, again, getting as many people to hold hands together for the sake of this fragile empire, right? Yeah. So that's not an inherently wrong or, you know, bad approach to a motivation, but it does position you in the way in which you're thinking about these questions ultimately differently. And so I think the way that I think about this then, in terms of what you've got there, is you really end up at Nicaea with various factions, all of them trying to do and preserve the faith in some way, shape, or form, but the way in which they're going about it can be shaped or skewed towards a particular motivation, which is where you end up getting, which is where you get up.
Well, so would you have put Arius kind of out there by himself, or was there a following? How would you characterize the nature of the battle? Is it a David versus Goliath, or kind of like, hey, one versus everybody else? Or is there some real, man, this is a battle that's, I don't say even, but he wasn't alone.
Yeah, no, Arius isn't alone. In terms of what he actually is pushing, he's in the great minority, mm-hmm. and that is driving this idea that Jesus is less than God. Whatever the motivation, whether it's a philosophical motivation, the idea of, you know, can we save ourselves of our works, a moralism, whatever, when pushed, Most Christians pushed back and said, "Now wait a minute, we're not saying what Arius is saying here." He uses this idea. There was a time when the Son, the S-O-N, mm-hmm. the Son of God, was not, that he didn't exist. And most Christians said, "Well, wait, we're not going to go there right. with this." But what they wrestled with is the idea of Jesus being the Son of God. So what language would I use when the Bible does talk about Jesus saying that the Father is greater than I am? So what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. Well, Christians had answers for that, but sometimes their language, just like today, I mean, you know, sometimes we say things that when someone pushes back on us, "Are you saying that Jesus isn't fully God?" We're like, no. I didn't mean to say that. I was just emphasizing one thing. Mm-hmm. So right. in the conversation, at first, you kind of have these two groups, or really three groups, that get lined up against one another. And then over time, as they actually present their case, people say, "Well, I'm really orthodox here. I really do believe the right thing. I believe what the Bible is saying against Arius." And so Arianism ends up being a very minority group in terms of what they actually did teach and believe. But they become prominent in a few places, one of them being North Africa, where Arianism really kind of takes a hold, which means several centuries later, when Islam comes through, kind of teaching this idea of there's only one God that's not triune, rejecting the idea that Jesus is God as well. There were a lot of people who, were willing to be sympathetic to it. Yeah, 100%.
And that's the way we find ourselves even in today's context, right? That there are other cults or religious sects or whatever mm-hmm. that would kind of, "I don't want to go as far as saying Jesus is God, and so I'm going to take seven." So while this may have been an issue that rose 1,700 years ago, it wasn't entirely resolved at the end of that, and there have still been people who have wrestled with this, whether they're in the church or outside the church, and kind of taken a different direction and ultimately—
Well, yeah, and still do today. I mean, when you get to Christmas and you talk about Jesus being born, there are people who think that Jesus as the little baby who is in the manger is just some human being who is there that has some connection to God, mm-hmm. not as the great song that we sing at Christmas about the herald angel singing, reminding us that when we see this child, that we're seeing deity veiled in flesh. That's the heart of what the Council of Nicaea was trying to do, was to ensure that when it comes to the question of Jesus, when we see Jesus, we see God, right? So when Jesus' disciples ask him, "When are you going to show us the Father?" Mm-hmm. He said, "Don't you know that if you see me, you have seen the Father?" And that is the opposite of what Arianism is trying to say. And that's as valid today as it was 1,700 years ago.
So here's some of the challenges. If you're thinking back then, historically, where you're quoting the Gospel of John, mm-hmm. That had not even been fully inscripturated as we would understand it. And so those things are still being formulated or identified as, "This is authoritative teaching, this is authoritative." And that teaching had not fully circulated or was still in the process of being adopted ecumenically, so to speak. And so having the final determiner of truth of, "Wait a minute, the scriptures say," that was still part of the formulation that was going on in the conversation. Or the context,
yeah,
right?
and that's a big part of what happens at the Council of Nicaea. And so the point that you're making there is so valid, that Christians believe the scriptural faith. All right, so they've always believed the teaching of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. that the Messiah was going to come, that he would be the Son of God and the Son of Man, and that Jesus says, "I'm that one." And so the message that the apostles preached, the apostolic writings, were in flux. Some people accepted some and some others. And along the way, as they're making these arguments about which faith we're going to embrace, they say there are, like, the Gnostic Gospels that present a different Jesus mm-hmm. to us mm-hmm. from these apostolic Gospels. And so the Council of Nicaea kind of comes to this conclusion for us, to say these are the texts that we identify as having preached to us this faith. So in so many ways, the Council of Nicaea was, it was not only necessary, but it was going to happen mm-hmm. Because Christians had to find a way to say, what are the scriptures that we're going to embrace? That this is going to be the source of the faith that we have and the source of the community of believers that we become. So what writings have made us what we are and have presented to us this gospel? And then what language can we use to best summarize and explain that to people? And that's where the council is.
So would you say too that what they determined about who they were believing Jesus to be then also became kind of a measuring stick of whether or not this book should be included in the scripture or this writing should be included as part of our authoritative kind of
absolutely. And that's what Irenaeus, for example, a theologian in the second century, had already been saying against these so-called Gnostics, mm-hmm. right, who were claiming to follow Jesus but were using different books and had a different picture of Jesus, that he's essentially saying the same thing,
right.
That the books that we're going to read are the ones that present Jesus to us as the Christ of the Old Testament. That's the ones that we're going to read. And that really is what identifies this New Testament canon for us.
And while that would be resolved at Nicaea, that comes later, 367 and 397 ultimately, it was another factor that was feeding this conversation. Right. Were there any other factors just in terms of what they believed, whether it was the scripture formation and what were going to be adopted as the scriptures, as well as who Jesus is, the practical elements? We talked about the political aspects of, you know, Constantine and his conversion and his understanding, all these things. Any other factors that were kind of at play that we should be kind of considering as we're walking through it?
Well, I mean, there are a host of other things beyond just the creed itself, mm-hmm. that we get, which is the focus of this. But when you've got the opportunity to have that many bishops together, mm-hmm. and that many leaders in the church, right. together, they're also going to ask some real practical questions. And so they were asking some they're important questions, not as significant as the question,
right.
who is the eternal son, but questions about the relationship between the bishoprics, the various sees themselves, and how are you going to call bishops, and how are you going to transfer bishops, move from place to place? This is where the Council of Nicaea even speaks to, certain dates in the Christians' liturgical calendar, mm-hmm. and what they're actually going to do with that. So it's not just this that they're doing.
There's some other issues
that they're also adjudicating. Why wouldn't you? You've got this opportunity. Though, to be clear, to Dr. McKinney's point, it really is the Arian controversy that precipitates this, both theologically but also politically for the emperor.
Yeah, one of the fascinating issues they deal with in a practical sense is Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because I mean Christmas. Okay, so we know when that is.
Right.
The 25th. It's right. like the same time every year, but the resurrection of Jesus had always been associated with the Jewish Passover, right? Because we have in the Gospels, you have the Passover. Jesus is crucified, then he's raised from the dead. So the question is, when do you celebrate Easter?
Hmm.
And you don't have the government telling you what the day is or right. however that gets on our calendar.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure how all those things show up, but you know exactly how it gets applied to us. But Christians in various places celebrated Easter differently. Some celebrated Easter where they celebrated the resurrection on the Passover, whatever day of the week that was. So we think of Easter Sunday, but there were some Christians who celebrated if it was Thursday or Tuesday or Wednesday. Whereas then most Christians celebrated it in relation to the Passover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a difference because the calendar changed, and the Jewish calendar was based on the moon, and the Roman calendar was based on the sun.
Mm.
So what happens when the time kind of shifts around or what have you? And so the Council of Nicaea needed to deal with, look, while we're all here,
yeah.
and we got people from all over the place, can we just settle on a single time that we're going to have Easter? But it was practical, but it was important, not because they were just asking, you know, are we going to meet at 9 o'clock in the morning? It's the most important day of the year for Christians. We celebrate Easter, the resurrection of Jesus. It was significant for them.
Well, when you look at that and you pull it in again into our context, the Council of Nicaea is not just about the most essential cornerstone truth of who we are as Christians. So it's not just what we believe and why we believe it. But there's how we approach the scriptures, how we come together to decide different things that affect all of us as believers, And then even some pragmatic issues as it relates to ministry. If we're talking to ministry leaders, we're talking to pastors and things today, we need to know these things because it really did impact and influence a lot of how we do church today or how we approach these various theological issues or situations as they arise and maybe can instruct and provide for us a model in that sense.
Yeah.
So we're going to dig into the details about the controversy itself, how it was resolved and what it resolved, but it didn't ultimately resolve all of these things. There were more. There's more to come. We'll talk about these details next time we get together and we'll continue the conversation for us and all of our friends.
Thanks.
Yep.